WIOX is supported by Delaware County Solid Waste Management Center on State Route 10 in Walton for disposal and recycling. Open 7:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Tuesday through Saturday. Delaware County Solid Waste Management Center information about materials and disposal fees at 607-832-5800 or see the Delaware County Solid Waste Management Center link at WIOXradio.org. WIOX is supported by Home Goods of Margaretville, corner of Main and Bridge Streets in Margaretville, New York. Now carrying spices, flour, jams, mustards, coffee and tea, organic vegetables and fruits, and local eggs, milk, cheese, and baked goods. And, of course, cooking basics and tools of the trade for everyone at home. Home Goods of Margaretville. Open Wednesday through Saturday, 11 to 5, 845-586-4177 or hgom.net. WIOX is supported by the Slighter Agency on Main Street in Margaretville, a neighborhood independent insurance agency educating consumers about the joys and challenges of owning a second home and about coverage options. Open Monday through Friday, 8:30 till 5. More information at 845-586-2641 or slideragency.com.
Hi, I'm John Madio, host of the Little Delaware Jamboree, an Americana music show, Monday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. here on WIOX Roxbury. We are community radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20, and WIOXradio.org.
Okay, you are listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org, where it's easy to donate if you like what you hear. You can also get WIOX on any smart device through the radio.fm app. This is From the Forest, every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Oh, things are good, Ryan. How are you?
I'm fine. Fine.
I mowed my lawn.
I tell you, man. I'm waiting until May 1st. That's it. This weekend, I think.
I waited that long last year, but I upgraded my mower, so I got anxious. I was like, I got to try this new thing out.
Oh, yeah.
So.
You know, a new mower, huh?
Not brand new. New to me.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yep. But you know what it did? It sparked the street. I lit the fire. And the neighbor mowed his, and
that's right.
It just starts that way.
My next-door neighbor and I are holding fast. We are the only two on the road, I think, that haven't mowed.
No?
Yeah. We're just like, you going to do it? No. We haven't said anything to each other, but that's the way it goes.
Right. Know? No, but as soon as, you know, one close neighbor does it, the other one feels obligated, I guess.
It's healthier. Let it go a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Build up some whatever. I don't know. I think it's better. in some ways. But after a while, it gets annoying, and the kids walk through there. There's a lot of ticks and stuff. So, but I don't know. Probably this Saturday.
Okay, I'll do mine the second time by then.
Been busy cutting trees down.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of trees, you know, here and there, too close to people's houses, whatnot.
Yeah, town of Delhi has emerald ash borer, quite bad now. It's like Margaretville was last year, I think.
Yeah.
And getting phone calls from people in Delhi to cut some hazard ash trees down.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that's it. I think that completes the Catskill Mountains at this point.
Yeah, white pine. White pine seems to be going down in places, you know?
No, I mean for emerald ash borer. I mean,
oh, yeah.
It came in from all sides, and I think the Delhi-Walton area was like one of the last
remaining. Bovina, too.
Bovina. But everybody's got it now.
Yeah.
It's over.
Yeah, it's over, huh? I know it. Well, it's a full show tonight. Tonight's topic is ancient artifacts in the forest with the Overlook Mountain Center, and we're speaking with Glenn Kreisberg. He's the chairperson there. He's a licensed outdoor guide for 20 years. Radio frequency engineer, writer, and researcher, serves as the VP of New England Antiquities Research Association. He's researched and published articles and interviews on electromagnetism and the ancients, historic bluestone quarrying in upstate New York, and lithic sites and alignments in the Northeast United States. He's a current editor of the Author of the Month page featured at grahamhancock.com, founder and editor of the alternative science and history website, ashnews.org. He resides in Woodstock with his wife and two children, and his first book titled Lost Knowledge of the Ancients is out now by Bear & Company. And let me see if I can get Glenn on. Glenn, you there?
Yes, hi. I am here. How are you?
We're well. How are you?
Good, thanks. I've got to correct you. You've got a 10-year-old bio there, so half of what you said was not current.
Oh, but, darn.
That's all right. These things get out there and they float around and you know, they're easy to find and sometimes they're just played out of date.
It's floating around. Yeah, it's floating around still.
Don't worry. Yeah. So I'm the former. I'll just bring everyone up to date. I'm the former vice president of NERA, the New England Antiquities Research Association. I did serve 2 3-year terms, starting in 2009 and ending in 2015. So there's that. And so basically, you got one from 10 years ago. So I've now been a licensed guide for 30 years instead of 20.
Okay, gotcha. And where are you based out of? Still Woodstock?
I'm sorry?
Still Woodstock?
Yes, I am still off of Maverick Road in Woodstock, where it's basically I grew up and lived my whole life.
Okay, yeah, I know where Maverick Road is. It was just down there. So how did you get involved in all this ancient rock formations and stuff? Yeah.
Yeah, it goes back to actually when I was a teenager. I was lucky enough to work in a bookstore here in Woodstock called Three Geese in Flight, which some people may remember. It was right on the green, and it was kind of an antiquarian bookstore having to do with ancient mythology, Native American mythology, Arthurian legend, all kinds of unusual Templar, you know, Knights Templar, so lots of different esoteric topics that drew me in as a young person, and read a lot about that stuff. And then, you know, I became a radio frequency engineer in my day job, and I was asked to sit on a siting committee in the town of Woodstock where they were going to place their cell tower. And some residents were concerned that where the tower was going to go was in proximity to some really unusual stone formations, these cairns, these piles of stones that are found up on Overlook Mountain. And they brought in the experts who basically said, oh, nothing to see here. This is, early American colonial field clearing, kind of a dime a dozen type of stuff, nothing really unusual. But the residents found their way to NERA, and one of their spokespersons spoke up and said that, well, these actually could be Native American and quite ancient and resources of cultural significance that should be looked at a little more closely and not simply dismissed. So that piqued my interest. I was like, an ancient mystery right here in the woods. And I had been a guide for many years and been in the backcountry. And probably everybody listening knows if you go walking in the woods in the Catskills, you're going to see unusual things made of stone, either old stone cellars or old stone walls or piles of stones, unusual boulders that seem to be set up at odd angles, supposedly left by the glaciers. So a lot of oddities in the woods, and the fact that some of them may not be from the European or the early American time period, I found fascinating and started researching it more and more. Found out that there were there was an 1880 survey, part of the census of I believe actually 1889, that determined there were over 250,000 miles of stone walls in the Northeast. So I found that incredible. It's like enough, you know, stone walls to reach the moon or to wrap around the Earth 10 times. So, I got curious. It didn't seem like all of that could have been built in the in a couple hundred years since, you know, a European population arrived. So, you know, looked like something that was a good mystery to kind of delve into, research, and, keeps me in the woods and out of trouble.
So, and now you're with the Overlook Mountain Center? Are you the chairperson there? Yeah. Is that true?
Yeah. Okay. That is true. It's a nonprofit that started in 2013 when 82 acres of land up on Overlook Mountain suddenly end up listed on the MLS for sale. Everyone had kind of assumed that these 80 acres, because they had been left undeveloped for the past 40 years, everyone kind of assumed that they had been protected in some way. But when they showed up on the, in the realtor's listing service to be sold, people got concerned, and we formed a nonprofit and went around raising awareness about this and approached a foundation that came up with money to help purchase the land and protect it in perpetuity. So we have there's two parcels up there, one that's about 42 acres and another that's 38 acres, and they are protected. They are private. We do run programming on one of them because it's covered with these stone formations, which we've researched and determined to be a ceremonial stone landscape. And that's done by bringing in the experts, archaeologists, and Native American tribal preservation officers who can look at these things and determine if they fit into the pattern of what are considered ceremonial. So it's a really interesting site that has a lot of features that we can talk about.
Yeah, I mean, it says here, the Overlook Mountain Center is a nonprofit organization that stewards the land and endeavors toward these goals and to provide educational and experiential programming in archaeoastronomy. I think that's a really cool word, archaeoastronomy. Can you explain that?
Sure. Archaeoastronomy is figuring out the way that ancient people used the sky, viewed the sky, both to measure time and as part of their ceremonial practices and kind of their belief system. So they would take observations of where the sun was on certain days of the year, the longest and shortest, and the solstices as well as the equinoxes, and they would pay close attention to the moon and where its position was throughout its cycle. It goes on a 19.6-year cycle from its minimum to maximum, kind of following the sun on the horizon, but going a little further in each direction at the extremes in the summer and in the winter. So native ancient people from all over the world used observational astronomy to create monuments, to mark time, to understand when the seasons changed. And archaeoastronomy is the study of how ancient people, performed that.
No kidding. That's pretty cool. I was reading, I think, Graham Hancock's book about some of these ancient civilizations, but I had no idea.
Well, you know, in the Northeast, the ancient Native population is not credited with doing anything in stone or having to do with archaeoastronomy. Everywhere else in the United States, everywhere else in the Western Hemisphere, everywhere else in the world, except the Northeast, ancient people are credited with doing this, making constructions and aligning them to events on the horizon. So for the Northeast ancient Native population to have been excluded from that, to me, did a terrible, disservice to them, in that they were just as smart, just as ingenious, just as capable of doing these things, just as sophisticated as all the other people around the world back thousands of years ago, and really right up to contact. But, of course, the Native population here had been decimated by the time there was a large European population and a lot of what they did got, you know, stepped on or destroyed by the culture that came after it. But it's important for everyone to remember that all the lands in the U.S., you know, all the parks, state parks, you know, national parks. In fact, when the national park system was formed, they had to clear the Native Americans off of the land so the federal government could take it over. So there's no land really that is not, and, you know, and still is the ancestral lands of the Native Americans who are still here active among us. You know, in school we're all taught about the natives in past tense, but there's very much a present tense to them, and these sites are part of that.
And why the Overlook Mountain? Why, what's the significance of Overlook Mountain?
Well, mostly because that's where the, this site was, the Lewis Hollow site, that was threatened by the development, by the sale of the land, or the potential sale of the land. But Overlook Mountain itself has a significance, you know, not only in our region, but kind of far and wide. You've got the Tibetan Buddhist monastery up there, the KTM Monastery, which is the center of Tibetan Buddhism in the United States. So they chose this site specifically because of Overlook Mountain and the meaning and the connection to the land that it has. The Onondaga, their council in 1979, also declared Overlook Mountain a sacred mountain. So when we found these stone constructions up in Lewis Hollow and started researching them and determined them as a ceremonial stone landscape, it fit in with that that information that this was a sacred mountain. And we also began to understand a little more in depth the esoteric information that was encoded in these stones, because there is an archaeoastronomy aspect to the Lewis Hollow site in that eight of the large constructions there, and these are stone cairns and stone walls that measure between 60 and 100 feet in length, they appear to reflect a constellation in the northern hemisphere called Draco, which is the serpent or the snake constellation. So there was a construction of these eight objects on the mountain that appeared to mirror the stars in this constellation Draco, which I didn't really know anything about until this this kind of this information came to me, and it ended up in the way of a GIS survey that was conducted by a woman named Susan Sweeney, who's with the New York State Museum, and she came out again, more than 10 years ago, and did a GIS survey, taking the GPS coordinates of all of these constructions, and there were 46 of the smaller cairns or stone piles purposely created, but then there were these eight large constructions that were huge, you know, like I said, 60 to 100 feet, and mapping those out and focusing on just those eight and kind of connecting the dots gave us the configuration that matched Draco. And Draco, it turns out, is a very important circumpolar constellation. It's always spinning around a spot in the sky that's known as celestial north, where the axis of the Earth points to. And because of something known as precession of the equinox, that's not a fixed point. It kind of scribes a slow 26,000-year circle in the sky. And the closest star to that point currently is Polaris, the North Star. But if you go back thousands of years, due to that precessional drift, you get a different star that was the closest point to celestial north, and that was Thuban, which is the brightest star, and it's the third star in the tail of Draco. So this was not lost on ancient people. There's a lot of mythology that speaks to Draco. It was known to the ancient Chinese, the ancient Greek, the ancient Persians, the ancient Norse. And I imagine it wasn't, you know, it was also known maybe by some other name to the native population as well, because apparently they built this construction, this petriform on Overlook that mirrors it very closely. Just recently, a very an interesting study was done by a gentleman named Mark Carlotto. And Mark is an engineer like myself, but he's also a specialist in mathematics and statistics and probabilities. And what he did was he matched up the construction on Overlook Mountain to the configuration of Draco in the sky to determine how close a correlation there was statistically, and he found it was between 82 and 83% accurate. And it was skewed slightly, and he believed due to the fact that people try to, you know, create a construction on the ground from something they saw in the sky would wouldn't necessarily be easy. they might not get it perfectly precise, and there could be some skewing, especially depending on when they created it. And that actually could be a method for dating it, because what Mark believed was that if it, at the point where it was the least skewed would be the point where they probably created it. And he determined that was about 3,000 years ago, which would really be fascinating. Now, we also, just this past September, took some samples from some of the constructions at Lewis Hollow. We took soil and rock samples from beneath the piles of stone there. This is a dating method known as OSL, or optically stimulated luminescence, which in essence lets you figure out when the last time sunlight shone on your samples. So if you take something from below a wall or from below a pile of stones, it will tell you the last time sunlight directly shone on the minerals in that sample and give you a way to date it. And there was a site that was dated last year in Pennsylvania using the OSL method, and it came back at 770 BC, plus or minus about 300 years, so about almost 2,500 years ago. And this was a site very similar to the site we see, the type of sites we see in the Catskills, which are large cairns, very purposely built, dry stacked stone piles that are not just farmers getting the stones out of the way or clearing the field, but something much more intentional and meaningful.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. with Ryan and John. Tonight's topic is ancient artifacts in the forest with the Overlook Mountain Center's Glenn Kreisberg. Glenn, yeah, I mean, that's what I want to know is these stone structures. You know, I've seen them bushwhacking when I was a ranger and stuff for the DEC up in some pretty remote areas. However, there's usually stone walls nearby where I know those agriculture going, and sometimes there's not. And that's why I'm interested. I'm forever a skeptic and stuff, so I'm not really sure. But, yeah, how do you decipher?
Well, that's a great question, and a lot of it has to do with just what you said, understanding the history of the land that you're on. And, the best place to do that is to start in the County Real Property Tax Office, where you can go back. You know, you find out where these things are on the land. They're on a piece of property that's got a section, block, and lot number, and you can start researching, you know, who the ownership was. If it's state land now, at some point it wasn't, and it was, you know, part of a patent or part of a subdivision that was cut out of a patent. So you start, it's almost like a process of elimination. You try to eliminate all the obvious possibilities, and there was a ton of agriculture and farm clearing and property beautification that involved moving stones and road building and quarrying and, you know, a lot of work that went on with the early settlers and right up through, early American and more modern times. There was a lot of exploitation of resources. And, you can try to figure out what those cultural footprints are. And in some cases, you find sites that are very pristine, that does not seem like there was a homestead nearby. There's a great site. We just did a site visit to, a hike to this past weekend up in Halkot Mountain, or Halkot, or I want to say it the way the locals do, that, you know, was mentioned in a 2017 Ulster County tourist guide as being 3,000 years old. I'm not sure where they got that age from, but when you go up to this site, you realize this is no place the farmers had ever been or would have had interest in. This is not a place they would have grazed their goats or livestock. It's a really kind of foreboding area.
Do you know what the elevation is?
It's about 1,800, maybe just above 1,800 feet.
Man, you would be surprised. I mean, the average maximum pasture was 2,500 feet. I mean, I've seen places where there was subsistence farms, what I would call the hill farms, which were the first abandoned before the Civil War. Well, Civil War. I mean, some of these places, they had a cow, did some buckwheat because they'd do their own grains because they had no rail at that time. I don't know. And you can't find anything. So how do you finally proof it, though?
Well, again, unless you have a Native American elder or a tribal preservation officer or somebody who's affiliated, you know, with the university or an institution that has the academic credentials, you're not going to. You're going to speculate. Now, the Halkot Mountain site is in a location that a lot of these suspected ceremonial landscapes are in, and this happens to be marking the headwaters of the Esopus watershed, I mean the extreme headwaters. We're talking, if you know where Bushnellville Kill is, coming out of 42 there, and again, there is no evidence that there's any homesteading directly related to the site, although nearby, where there's a little bit more bottomland west of there, yes, there are farms and homesteads, and that, you know, people have been settling in there for a long time. But this is a site that is obviously marking springs. The cairns and the walls are built, and these are not straight walls or enclosures. They're like serpentine walls that are, you know, serpent-like and effigy-like. You know, and an effigy is a representation, a representation of an animal or spirit figure, and it could be created, you know, in wood, in stone, in fabric. It's just a replica of something that resembles something important, and usually it's an animal or a totem. So when you find sites that are filled with obvious turtle effigies or turtle cairns, we call them, and there are sites like Spruceton Valley that they're just, it's, you know, hard to deny that looking at this thing, it doesn't resemble a turtle or serpent. And these are prominent figures and creatures in Native American mythology and spirituality, actually. So, you know, again, it's a process, and until there's a Native tribe that comes up and takes ownership of it and recognizes it as such, then it's just, you know, us white guys speculating on what it could be. But, again,
well, I mean they do have to prove it. I mean, I know, I mean, I'm Dutch, but I can't tell you anything about Dutch from the 1600s, even though my family is all there. I mean, I would have to prove it somehow by either radiocarbon or archaeological practices, right? I mean, something.
Yeah, for it to be accepted and protected. But, you know, it's interesting because you mentioned the Dutch ancestry, and when the Dutch showed up here, they named a lot of things devil, you know, Devil's Tombstone, Devil's Acre, Devil's Kitchen. These were usually places where the Calvinist Dutch saw Native Americans conducting spiritual ceremonies, and the Calvinist, you know, the Dutch considered the natives to be devil worshippers. So, you know, that's in the history books, and that's unfortunate. But of course, they were not devil worshippers. That was just the interpretation of the Calvinists and of the Europeans. Who labeled them as savages and, of course, incapable of civilization. And what these sites are, and there are, you know, a handful now that have been documented by the experts as ceremonial stone landscapes. So that is a thing that is accepted among academics. It's just not every site that fits that pattern has been, you know, confirmed as such. And, in fact, unless the site is threatened in some way, it probably won't get that kind of research put into it. It'll just remain, a mysterious site in the woods that people can experience if they're lucky enough to come across it. And then through the kind of the education and the awareness raising that we're trying to do, help them better understand it in its proper cultural context instead of lumping it in with something that it's not.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty cool. I mean, there's another headwaters area where I bushwhack every year. And it has a series, a huge area, probably over, you know, an acre and a half of stone rocks piled on a boulder, usually, it seems to me. And it is at a headwaters area. Now, I know there was farming in that area by just subsistence farmer because another, he's since passed away, but West Shokan resident did some research in the area. But it, you know, who's to say? And even if there was farming, that doesn't say it's not Native American either, because maybe they went there because there was already a road or trail going up there. I don't really know. You know?
Oh, any place that was of interest to the settlers would had already been of interest to the Native population for 10,000 years. If it was something that was useful, a view shed, a river crossing, a resource to get useful building materials, that was not lost on the Native population for 10,000 years. The Europeans just were the most recent to discover it and name it and exploit it. But, that's important to remember. And you're right, they're not mutually exclusive. It makes it a little more difficult to discern, but you may, you know, when you have a group that spent 10,000 years putting their cultural footprint on the land, and then you have another group come in for a few hundred years and impact that. You know, if you look carefully and you know how to read the landscape and understand its relationship to the sky and to this, its environment, you can, you know, start to decipher some of the meaning and understand a little better what these things are.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it from a forester's perspective. To me, I can kind of visualize where the Native Americans were most prominent by their legacy they've left behind through the trees. Oak, hickory, and chestnut, low bush blueberry. Overlook Mountain is just chock full with mountain laurel and all pyrogenic species, I think, because the natives were burning from the valley and fire burns uphill and then it burns the hottest on top of the hill, which to this day has rattlesnakes, which, you know, thrive in fire-prone areas. I think that's just a legacy from Native Americans. So I'm not surprised that you find stone structures on Overlook. But you see that in other areas like High Point and stuff as well, where there's huge pyrogenic legacy. Where there are the least, I would say, would probably be the interior, although it may just be covered over because we've had literally like almost 500 years of growth since, you know, that those major fires.
We're way overdue for a big fire in the Catskills. Nobody really, you know, well, you guys probably realize that, but, yeah, we haven't had any kind of major widespread burn like used to take place regularly due to nature or the Native Americans who did this in a very measured and practical manner.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think we get natural fire. I really don't believe that. I think it's mostly artificial, and it always has been from human beings. I mean, even the Shangum Ridge where I grew up on, I think 99% or more were always started by humans, and I think it's benefited the mountain. I really do, but.
Oh, it has. I spent my early years as a Mohonk Preserve Ranger, and then as a guide down there, yeah. And they do a good job with their prescribed burns and control the undergrowth that way. But I do, but they have had some big fires. You're right. I think the ones in Minnewaska were set by humans.
Yeah.
But they could have easily, if they were back in you know, earlier times before humans here, been started by lightning if the conditions were right and burn unchecked if there was no effort to stop them.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. I do think that's something that, and of course there was a serious attempt to monitor fire in the Catskills with the tower system that was put up in the early 1900s, in the early 20th century. So, you know, that required there to have been a fairly substantial threat for them to have undertaken that.
Yeah. Yeah, now we've talked that with University of Arizona's Stephen Pine. That's kind of the war on fire and suppression and stuff that occurred. But fire's rare. That maple leaf wants to stick to the forest floor and not burn. And once you get maple moving in, it gets more and more difficult.
We're practically a rainforest here in the Catskills. If we just had a little more rain every year, we'd almost fall into that category. So you're right. Things are generally not conducive. But, you know, we have high burn. High burn times when you really got to be careful. Yeah. But in general, I'd say you're right. We don't live in a threat like California or other areas.
So Glenn, maybe define some terms for people. Like, what's an effigy, a spirit stone, petroform? I know you mentioned them, but, you know, I always like to define the terms and you know, clearly state what these are.
Okay. Well, I think I explained an effigy, a stone effigy in particular might be a construction out of stone that resembles some kind of creature or mythological being. In this case, we see so many turtle effigies in the Catskills, and we have to relate them in some way to the myth, the creation myth of the Native Americans that involves the turtle. And we also know that the turtle clan was a prominent clan in the Catskills. So effigies of turtles are constructions out of stone that look like turtles. Effigies of serpents are serpentine walls, usually ending with an erratic as its head, that, again, resemble a serpent or a snake and don't have any practical purpose like an enclosure or a property boundary. Petroform is just something made out of stone that creates a form. So an effigy could be considered a petroform, but also the star map of Draco on Overlook is also that would be considered a component petroform because it's made of several different stone structures that together create a figure or an object. What were some of the other terms you're looking for?
Archaeoastronomy, which you already did, but basically you're saying was that to do with a map of the stars I've heard about in the past, or nothing?
There was
some people around here I've heard tell me, some friends of mine, they talk about the map of the stars, where they think people like Native Americans were mapping basically the stars from these effigies or stone structures.
Yep, that's the that's what I was describing on Overlook with the Lewis Hollow site, but there are several others that have been identified. There is a researcher, a scholar named Evan Pritchard, who is Native American. Some of your listeners may know of Evan. He's written quite a few books. He's taught at Marist and at Vassar, Native American Studies and Philosophy and Ethics. And he has some sites that he holds very close. He doesn't share. But he says that he's convinced they are star maps on the ground in the Catskills, and he thinks that there's actually it's a widespread phenomenon. He thinks that there may be a map of the entire northern hemisphere mapped out on the ground in the Catskills with stone structures. So, I find that very fascinating. You asked about spirit stones. The native term for these sites is Manitou Hashanesh. And Manitou being spirit, and Hashanesh being stones. And the Manitou Hashanesh is the Algonquin term for spirit stones, and that's what we believe these sites are that represent ceremonial stone landscapes. They would be considered these Manitou Hashanesh. So, they're important sites of cultural significance that really deserve a tremendous amount of respect. And, when people come across this stuff, they should be careful not to disturb it. I think it makes sense to bring it to the attention of the town historian, whatever town it's in. And there is an effort underway to get memorandums of understanding adopted by town boards and by county legislatures recognizing ceremonial stone landscapes as defined by USET, which is the United Southern and Eastern Tribes. They're an organization of kind of an umbrella organization for federally recognized tribes on the East Coast. And they issued a memorandum in 2007 declaring and describing ceremonial stone landscapes as being often overlooked by archaeologists and historians for not being what they actually are. And they describe them as being stacked stones, stone rows, stone piles, or important boulders, some of them marking sites of important events in Native American history. So it's something that should be recognized and not ignored and understood for what it actually is.
I'll go ahead, John.
I was going to say, so how can someone identify, just walking in the woods, what might be the difference? Is there anything completely obvious or no?
I think there is. I think when you see and this isn't uniform and universal, but I do think there's a difference in construction technique. I think Europeans and European stone workers had a Eurocentric view. They tried to lay things in courses, laterally, horizontally. You see lines through the European walls that are kind of continuous. Native American walls appear a little more, haphazard. They don't have the same orderly construction technique as a Eurocentric wall. So they also tend to be wider at the bottom and narrower at the top. I think they're built a little more to stand up to time than the European walls, which a lot of times end up crumbling and falling over due to their kind of angular and right angle to the ground construction. So not all European stone workers were that careful and skilled, so I think their walls would not have lasted. These walls that we think are associated with Native American spiritual sites are really substantial. Some of them, we refer to them as mega walls. They're literally two walls built at an angle leaning into each other, but far enough apart so that they can be filled with rubble in between.
And how do you decipher those from plowing, or they're plowing?
You mean
Yeah, because I see those. Yeah, I mean, I see where there's two walls leaning against each other, and they fill it in with the middle. A lot of times, because you know they're plowing or they're digging and they're planting crops, they just throw them in the middle as the rocks rise to the top. How can you decipher from that?
I don't know that you can. They may be similar techniques, and that you may have something that looks quite similar. The walls I see that are double walls.
Yeah.
And filled in are serpentine. They're not an enclosure. They're not following a property boundary. They're just kind of, you know, a 90-foot wall that takes a little gentle bend in the middle of it, and it's, you know, kind of enigmatic. Why is this here? What's its purpose?
Right.
And again, having knowledge of the history of the particular land that you're finding these on and what you know, kind of activity was carried out there, if you can find that it was a homestead or that people were there, you know, doing subsistence farming, they, you know, that then you can't rule that out. That's probably what it is, and they certainly did a lot of that and needed to get the stone out of the way. But, again, you're not necessarily going to see something that's neatly constructed or that has any kind of aesthetic or artistic element to it. And a lot of times you find these walls in the woods that are just so, you know, graceful in their appearance and you know, kind of like awe-inspiring that it almost seems like it can't be anything but ceremonial. But of course, you know, humans like to project things and beliefs and are very fanciful and are able to see patterns and make order out of chaos. You know, that's kind of something our brains do anyhow. So we do look for answers, and sometimes we supply them to ourselves, whether they're the right ones or not.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is Ancient Artifacts in the Forest with Overlook Mountain Center's Glenn Kreisberg. We're going to take a break, and we got some more questions when we turn for Glenn.
My possessions are called
All right. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic. Tonight's topic is ancient artifacts in the forest with Overlook Mountain Center's Glenn Kreisberg. Glenn, just one more question about the proofing. What I read on here on your site that there's lichen colony growth that can be studied as well. You know anything about that?
Yes. I've been trying to get Mohonk Preserve interested in doing this on some of the sites down in their neck of the woods. Yeah, there are some regions and some studies that have been done, mostly in northern latitudes like Norway and Alaska, where they are able to study the rate of the growth of lichen on the stone since it's been exposed and understand how long that lichen colony has existed there. And in some cases, lichen has grown in the same spot for thousands of years. And they can tell that, again, not me, but a specialist in lichen and plant growth can, I think it's more conducive to do it in northern latitudes because it grows more slowly in the Arctic, so they're able to gauge it a little better. But really the best hope for proofing these days is the OSL, the optical stimulated luminescence dating. And NERA has embarked on I mentioned last September, the Lewis Hollow site was tested. We won't get results for about a year from University of Washington. And it's Dr. Feathers and some geoscientists who worked with him who supervised the taking of those samples. But at the same time, they did sampling throughout the Northeast, sites in Pennsylvania, as I mentioned, New Hampshire, Vermont, I believe Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and Connecticut all had sites. Similar to ours in the Catskills that I've been discussing, samples taken and sent to the lab so that we can get some results and date some of these sites more accurately. That's a big way. I mean, if it's 770 BC, it's Native American. It's,
right. You know, right. Yeah. Sure. I would think so.
or if it's 300, 300 years old, then it's it could very well be colonial or early American.
Oh, yeah, I would think it has to be if it's 300 years. Don't you think?
Well, again, they're not mutually exclusive. This is a phenomenon that, and these sites are still used by natives today. Like I said, they're not in past tense. These are still active ceremonial sites. The natives consider them prayers in stone. They consider them essential to having balance and harmony in their life, and that's why they still utilize these sites. So it's it's possible that they are, some of them may have been created right up into contact period and still being utilized to this day.
John, anything? You have questions?
Well, I mean, I guess if they're utilized to this day, then who do we ask?
Yeah. Well, you ask, potentially you ask the Lenape people, you asked the Stockbridge Munsee Band of Mohican, and again, these would be the tribal preservation offices. If you come across these sites, you can reach out to your local historian or the New York State Museum. You can reach out to a local tribe or an affiliated tribe. There are quite a few in New York. The Catskills were kind of a border region between tribal nations and tribal confederacies. You had the Iroquois to the west, you had the Mohawk to the north, the Mohican and the Lenape to the east and to the south. And they did not divide their land up the way we do, where, one state is on one side of the river and another state is on the other side of the river. It was basically watersheds. All the land associated with that creek or that stream or that river would belong to one or be claimed by one group and sometimes challenged. But it's not an easy task to identify who these sites belong to. But I think it's worth the effort to get the answers.
Yeah, we deal with forest owners, and I would just say as a recommendation from what I've experienced with forest owners and the Endangered Species Act that I think landowners are going to be reluctant to come forward with this information if they feel they might be penalized. I think you might get more people coming forward with this information if they didn't think they were going to be penalized by the county, state, or federal.
Oh, well, penalized, that's a strong word. This is just giving recognition and understanding what they are. These memorandums of understanding, they really are they have no teeth. They're just acknowledging that ceremonial stone landscapes exist, and that when they're identified, they you know, should be recognized as resources of cultural significance, just like, you know, a covered bridge or an old barn. You know, once you understand its history and who was involved with it and what role it played in, sure, in culture, it's, gets a little easier.
Yeah. I'm just saying people are wary. That's all.
Yeah. You know? No, I agree. And you know, there are a lot of skeptics and a lot of people who will dismiss this, especially if they've got a project going that they don't want to have been, disturbed. And, it's nothing important. So
I mean, we deal with thousands of landowners. I think actually people want to find them. And I think they have, most people we talk to, John, right? They have strong reverence for the past like this. In fact, I think they would love it.
Definitely.
People would love to have someone come on their land and proof it and say, yeah, this is Native American. I think most people would have strong reverence for that. I really do.
And even going back in history, I think when the settlers first arrived and they came across these things, I think they were reluctant to disturb them. And I think they did much more than modern historians. Yeah. I think they were recognized in colonial times by people like Jefferson and Ezra Stiles, who was the first chancellor of Yale University. He very much was aware of these ceremonial stone landscapes and the importance they had. You know, they had held to the native population. It's kind of lost information.
So where is there some other sites in the Catskills? You mentioned Overlook Mountain, Halkett Mountain. Do you know of more?
Oh, well, there's dozens and dozens of them. I do have a book out that I'll just mention because you mentioned my first book in 2010, but I had one out in 2018 called Spirits and Stones that documents many of the sites. It doesn't reveal locations except for a few that are on state land. But you do have sites, in Spruceton Valley on Plateau Mountain. Huckleberry Point has a significant site above what's known as the Wall of the Manitou that runs from, kind of Woodstock up to Catskill. Many sites in the Shawangunks, smaller sites throughout Woodstock, like in Bearsville and Mink Hollow and Silver Hollow, many of the hollows, because those are the headwaters of the streams. They start in those amphitheaters high up in those hollows where the water drains down. And there's also a strong, under the Native Americans had a three-dimensional worldview. Everything on the plane of the living where we exist was connected to the celestial world above and to the underworld. And there's a lot of unseen hydrology that are associated with these sites a particular researcher, it's covered in one of the chapters of my book, a gentleman named Dave Johnson goes around to these sites and douses them and understands how the underground hydrologic features connect to the constructions on the surface. So he's made a correlation between where stone sites are built and where areas of higher permeability, fractures in the bedrock that allow groundwater and aquifers to seep up and feed the springs year-round. So that's a pattern that he's found throughout the U.S. and even down in South America.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I was reading a book on it, and I guess a lot of indigenous people have wanted to map the stars. I mean, humans have always been fascinated by the stars, and it's not, to me, unimaginable that they would do it here, for sure.
Yeah, that just doesn't make sense that they wouldn't look up at the sky the way other people do, the way we do today, and make note of things. So archaeoastronomy was a very strong component, and what I call landscape archaeology, using and utilizing the landscape to create these monuments that represent, memorialize the events that they see in the sky. So a lot of these sites are pointing, the walls are pointing to specific azimuths on the horizon that are where the sun rises or sets on the longest or short days of the year. And again, that's kind of objective. The math is the math. If something aligns along a 303-degree northwest azimuth, it's pointing to a summer solstice sunset. And we see this, again, a pattern that's repeated in many sites. And it's one of the ways, to John's question, that you can determine if a site may have cultural significance to an ancient people is, are these are these constructions aligned, and does it fit a pattern? So a lot of times the answer is yes.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is Ancient Artifacts in the Forest with Overlook Mountain Center's Glenn Kreisberg. Glenn, we only got about a minute and a half. What's up next at the Overlook Mountain Center? Anything you want to talk about?
Well, we do schedule hikes regularly. We do have one coming up May 16th to the Lewis Hollow site. If you go to overlookmountain.org and scroll down a little, there's a schedule for the year. The hike's subject to change, but we do you know, at least once a month. And towards the fall, we do some campouts at some of these sites and, you know, cook some good food and tell some good stories. So we also, throughout the year, do workshops and on archaeoastronomy and landscape archaeology, showing on PowerPoint and with photographs and maps and charts how this all works and what it all looks like. So, you know, I invite people to check out the website and, you know, get in touch if you're interested in some of the programming.
Awesome. Hey, thanks for coming on tonight. We appreciate you taking the time answering our questions.
That was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
Bye now.
If you just missed the show, that was Ancient Artifacts in the Forest with Overlook Mountain Center's Glenn Kreisberg. And next week, John, believe it or not, guess what we're doing?
What is it?
I'm going to be talking to a guy in New Hampshire about making sycamore syrup.
What?
That's crazy.
You found someone who can do it.
I don't know. We'll see.
Because that person's not me.
He says he's unraveled it. I talked to this guy in New Hampshire a few years ago, but he says he finally made more.
Awesome. I'm going to pick his brain.
Yeah, you pick his brain, man. And that's all time we got. See you next week.
Good night.
Oh, the neon lights were flashing and the icy wind did blow. The water seeped into his shoes and the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at the game. In an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest. With a mighty roar, the big jet soared.